Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Chasing Bright Medusas, A Life of Willa Cather by Benjamin Taylor. During the difficult months of 2020, a writer friend and I decided to read Willa Cather's fiction together. What a good antidote to despair that was. Much of it was rereading, but I'd missed some stories and novels, and I'd never read them sequentially or with a clear sense of Cather's life. That spring, I also delved into several of the biographies, which taught me something about how such books can vary. Tonally and politically different, written with obvious adoration or apparent dislike, focusing intently on Cather's work or scrutinizing her private life. So many biographies. From Edith Lewis's personal record in Willa Cather Living to the massive, almost day-by-day accounting of James Woodruff's Willa Cather, A Literary Life, and the detailed critical readings of Hermione Lee's Willa Cather, Double Lives. I learned lots about Cather, and sometimes more than I wanted about her biographers. A fresh perspective on Cather's sexuality came from Sharon O'Brien's Willa Cather, The Emerging Voice, while Joan Acosella provided a witty, abrasive take on academic analyses of Cather's work in Willa Cather and the Politics of Criticism. In the midst of this maelstrom, I often wished I could find a brief, clear introduction to Cather's life and work, a book that would intrigue and illuminate without bogging down in scholarly disagreements. Benjamin Taylor, the author of an excellent brief biography of Proust, a short, lively memoir of his long friendship with Philip Roth, and two novels, among other works, offers just that with Chasing Bright Medusas. His crisp sketch of Cather's life, a portrait, as she described her vision for one of her own novels, like a thin miniature painted on ivory. Portraying Cather with the sort of swift, opinionated strokes she herself used to create her characters, Taylor offers an elegant literary essay rather than new facts or startling interpretations. I wish to frame the story as driven by Cather's antagonism to the times in which she lived, he states early on. She believed in luck, particularly her own, and believed in the luck-making power of desire. She had a destiny, devoutly believed in. She swept aside impediments. Her goals were vividly before her. Others might interpret her life's journey differently, but a portrait this succinct relies on such sharp generalizations. Brevity exposes a writer's attitudes. Selection and emphasis, I'm thinking here especially of Willa Cather's fiction, are everything. In a famous 1922 essay, The Novel des Meubles, she wrote, "Whatever is felt upon the page without being specifically named there, that, one might say, is created. It is the inexplicable presence of the thing not named, of the overtone divined by the ear but not heard by it, the verbal mood, the emotional aura of the fact or the thing or the deed." Whisking through the decades, Taylor propels us from Cather's birth in Northern Virginia to her family's move in 1882, when she was 9, to rural Nebraska. From there, it's on to the town of Red Cloud, and through her first years as a wildly talented college student, acting and dressing more like a boy than a girl, cropping her hair short, going to class in starched white shirts and suspenders, and affecting a low voice at the then new University of Nebraska in Lincoln. During her years as a working journalist, she wrote hundreds of columns for the Nebraska State Journal, and after a move to Pittsburgh, churned out reviews and articles, first for Home Monthly Magazine, and then for the Pittsburgh Leader, well over a million words of journalism. In 1899, she met and formed a deep relationship with her great love, Isabel McClung. She moved into McClung's family house and started teaching high school, while still, somehow, also writing fiction. Those years of frenzy, as she called them. Yet soon enough, her fiction entered into the world. The Troll Garden, her first collection, was published in 1905. Even while acting as managing editor for the famous magazine McClure's, she pressed on, although, as she wrote to a friend, reading so much poorly written matter, as I have read, has a kind of deafening effect on me somehow. I know that many great and wise people have been able to do that, but I am neither large enough nor wise enough to do it without getting a kind of dread of everything that is made out of words. She published her first novel, Alexander's Bridge, in 1912, immediately recognizing it as a false start. Then the one she claimed as her second first novel, O Pioneers, in 1913. At 40, she was finally launched. Big chunks of life occur off stage. Details vanish. Time is elided. But Taylor knows when to break down. He deftly conveys the pathos of Cather's long struggle to establish herself as a fiction writer and the personal and professional troubles that pushed her toward a new aesthetic in the wake of One of Ours, a plump, some would say overstuffed, novel about a soldier during World War I that won the Pulitzer Prize in the spring of 1923, but received some harsh and, to Cather, wounding reviews. Taylor argues convincingly that the late style Cather developed after 1922, the breakthrough is to a simplified manner in which earlier preoccupations are dispensed with in favor of a new expressiveness, a new simplicity, produced what he considers her masterpieces. I agree. A Lost Lady, The Professor's House, Death Comes for the Archbishop, and Obscure Destinies among them. Spangling the narrative are quotes from Cather's letters. Until they were published in 2013, they could only be paraphrased, which give a sense of her vivid voice. If only I could nail up the front door and live in a mess, I could simply become a fountain pen and have done with it, a conduit for ink to run through, she wrote to a friend in 1913 while pounding away on The Song of the Lark. The beating heart of this book isn't Taylor's use of the letters, though, but his sure-handed sense of how to shape a propulsive narrative, which aligns with Cather's own methods. Think of her daring structural leaps in The Professor's House. It takes real confidence, as well as real depth of knowledge, to see clearly the territory of such a complex life and massive work, and to decide what must be touched on and what must, sadly, fall by the side. Some scholars may take issue with what Taylor chose to include or omit, but for the rest of us, whether new to Cather's fiction or longtime fans curious about her life, this is the perfect introduction. This review was written by Andrea Barrett, the author of Natural History, the National Book Award-winning Ship Fever, and other works of fiction newly reissued in paperback. The Book of Ein by Lexi Fryman. A bucket of moldy jam stored in the walk-in storage closet of an L.A. cafe. Famous men masturbating in front of young women. Misappropriated campaign funds. Such real-life cancellation plots provide the unspoken backdrop to Lexi Fryman's angular, careening latest, The Book of Ein, which charts a writer's undoing after she publishes an opioid crisis satire written from a rent-free pied-à-terre with a view of the Empire State Building. This is a gamey picaresque for the age of the Notes app apology, a cutting novel of ego and its death, Freudian yearning, Randian Hollywood, scatological epiphany, and the vileness of the pursuit of a career in letters. By the end of the first paragraph, Fryman has already dropped the anvil of cancellation on her protagonist, Anna, whose aforementioned satire is panned in the New York Times as classist. Since the age of 3, Anna has compulsively used off-off-off color humor to blunt life's miseries. Painting the walls of her parents' room with feces in an attempt to massage the grief over her infant brother's death. The joke didn't land, but that hasn't stopped Anna from fouling up her life ever since. I was just trying to write humorous fiction, she says of her voyeuristic poverty porn that loudly mocks the whole concept of trauma, trying to bring a little slapstick to the ongoing national tragedy. Guillotined as a narcissist by the paper of record, Anna finds herself lured toward the numb leap of provocation, tearing through the few remaining social events on her calendar, hunting for trouble. After being all but removed from a clitoridectomy awareness luncheon for asserting that the clitoris is actually privileged, she smacks into an Ayn Rand tour paused on the sidewalk to watch a hawk tear the head off of a pigeon. Anna gently asks the group what Ayn might have said about cancel culture. Breathless, they tell her. Anna reads up on Ayn and grows giddy with my new heresy. Like a naughty joke, Rand's objectivism strikes her as true because it's wrong. To her best friend Vivian, a second-and-a-half-wave feminist who considers Rand philosophy something rich psychopaths use to justify their greed, she replies that the author thought women could do literally anything except be the president. At a dissident soiree of centrists in the West Village, she evangelizes Rand to two podcasters who troll the victim caliphate by making pasta for war criminals. A venture capitalist connects her with his son, a scrabbling talent manager who predicts that cancellation was about to become cool, and who suggests she write a TV show about her new god. Heading west, Anna thrills. Ayn, too, went to Hollywood at 39. In Los Angeles, Anna does the usual. She gets a Craigslist roommate who never flushes. She walks dogs to make rent. She does goat yoga next to a woman whose mat reads, "God is dead, be kind to yourself." She courts a bland actress for the role of the original girl boss. She gets recanceled for triggering a queer and diverse TV show cast at a party. She falls behind on her pilot and turns to Adderall. Rand finished the fountainhead on Benzedrine, which gives her diarrhea so torrential and emptying she's able to see objectivism for the strangling vine it is, at last. Hoping to annihilate and remake herself, Anna follows Vivian to an ego-suicide workshop on the Greek island of Lesbos. The culty folks who run the commune share everything, including a fevered reverence for the long-dead guru they still call the master. Anna pops from perineum stimulation workshops to laughter meditations to sex with a teenage refugee she nicknames Baby. As her ego slowly dies, she has disturbing fantasies of motherhood, struggles to distinguish Rand's maxims from the master's YouTube rantings about the futility of altruism and the paradox of the self, and begins to fear the only thing she'll ever be able to write is Eat, Pray, Love, narrated by Humbert Humbert. It's all only 30 euros a night. Fryman's singularly funny 2018 debut, Inappropriation, dealt in similar ideas. Our humorless century, the allure of cult logic, the quest for a credo. Fans of that book will miss its strange particular tenderness. Here instead is a furious, jagged, and radiant reckoning with the dangers of the manifesto, the mortifications of aging, the mercies and limitations of the comic posture, the job of the novelist, and the indiscriminate desecration it demands. This review was written by Alexandra Tanner, whose first novel, Worry, is forthcoming. Gator Country, Deception, Danger, and Alligators in the Everglades, by Rebecca Renner. The journalist Rebecca Renner still lives in Central Florida, where she grew up playing in a swamp near her house and had her first close encounter with a full-size alligator at age 7. When she decided to write a nonfiction book about alligator poaching, she knew it would mean a return to the swamp, in this case, the grassy and forested wetlands to the south, and was thrilled. Gator Country would be a chance to tell a tale of not only wildlife cops and robbers, but also the magical, extraordinary Everglades, often denigrated and dismissed by outsiders as glibly as the exploits of Florida Man. The Everglades are a place of ethereal beauty, full of the trailing lacework of Spanish moss and the towering shelter of cypress, of orchids that grow on trees and draw nourishment from the humid air, of panthers and egrets and mangroves, home to hundreds of kinds of fish and birds and reptiles. And they're on the front lines of planetary transformation, an ecosystem hanging by a thread. Their fragile biomes and abundance of unique life are threatened not only by urban sprawl, climate change, and destructive invasives like water hyacinth and Burmese pythons, but also by the pressure of poaching. Poaching of the Everglades' native species includes the harvesting or killing of endangered plants and animals and the picking of palmetto berries without the proper permits, to which one of Renner's students once confessed. Alligators are among the targets. Though their populations were plummeting by the 1960s, they're plentiful again thanks to the Federal Endangered Species Act, whose 1967 precursor law protected them for 20 years and may well have prevented their extinction. These days, the ancient reptiles are so common they've become frequent sights along the waterways of Florida and other southeastern states. I once encountered several hundred in a single two-hour paddle through the Okefenokee. Gators can now be hunted and legally farmed for their meat, and, more lucratively, their skins and other body parts, which are made into boots and purses and sold as trophies and shellacked trinkets. The tiny snaggle-toothed heads of baby alligators can decorate your keychain or swing from your rearview mirror for a few bucks. But there's a hitch, Renner writes. Since alligators refuse to reproduce in captivity, farmers have to get their eggs from the nests of free-living animals. Collection is regulated at the state level, but difficult to monitor in the depths of the swamp, where females build raised nests of mud and feces in which to incubate their eggs. Although the species population is currently healthy, the removal of too many eggs could drive it back to scarcity. So Renner set out to document the adventures of one man whose job it was to bring egg poachers to justice. Jeff Babuata, a former canine officer of the state's Fish and Wildlife Commission, who went deep undercover as an alligator farmer to root out the thieves. The account of Jeff's multi-year ordeal has all the gritty mundaneness of any day-to-day job, with alligator wrangling, outlaw finessing, method acting, and risk to life and limb thrown in. Though Babuata was a law enforcement officer, Renner recounts he often felt a kinship with the poachers he was tasked to bring in. After all, people who live near the swamp and are of the swamp do far less damage to its survival and integrity than those who come from afar to buy the newly built homes for which much of Florida has been denatured and drained, or the developers and politicians who cater so eagerly and profitably to that voracious demand. The weirdness of Sunshine State culture has been fetishized in media and art, most recently in cringy memes and the quirky Florida-based fictions of writers like Karen Russell and Lauren Groff. But as Renner puts it, I was tired of reading stories that treated the Glades and all of Florida, really, as a wild and wacky backdrop where characters and tall tales abounded, where normal folks vacationed, but where real people didn't live. Instead, Renner gives the remarkable nature of South Florida, as well as the often hardscrabble folk whose families have lived there for generations, the love and respect they deserve. What she and Babuata share is a reverence for the creatures of the swamp, a sense of wonder at their mysteries, and a desperate wish for others to feel that wonder, too. Alligators aren't easy poster children for conservation. They aren't cuddly-looking pandas or playful sea otters. Rather, they crawl toward us out of the dark ooze, slowly opening long jaws lined with sharp teeth. They lure in the murk like primordial fear and sometimes find themselves on the wrong side of a golf course fence. But they're as singular and magnificent as the Everglades themselves. Every species and every person who fights for its continued existence deserves a book like this, a book that explores the complexity of the nexus between humans and animals and the exploitation of the wild, and considers the ambiguities of our fractured relationship to nature, morality, and history. This review was written by Lydia Millett, whose first work of nonfiction, We Loved Them All, will be published in 2024. Move Like Water, My Story of the Sea, by Hannah Stowe. The vast, ever-changing beauty of the ocean and its creatures' epic lives have always called to Hannah Stowe, a writer who shares with us her response to that calling in her distinctly wet and salty new coming-of-age memoir. Move Like Water is, above all, a sensuous book, more felt than described, more described than explained, more painted than penned, part memoir, part journal, and, with each chapter named for a creature the author encountered, either in real life or in dreams, part natural mystery tour. Stowe grew up in Pembrokeshire, Wales, in a cottage by the coast, with a loving mother, an accomplished artist who wisely encouraged her daughter's budding passion. There was never a time when I did not know the sea, Stowe writes. The weather was never far away. But not everyone around her understands the storm brewing in her teenage heart. Her challenge is how to achieve escape velocity from the relative banality of working life expectations. At a careers week she attends as a teen, talks from the Marines were pitched to the children as adventure, the inevitable violence concealed. Her future boiled down to vocation, plumber or electrician. Stowe could sense but not articulate her longing for a different path. I wanted to feel intrepid, to experience the rush of nerves as you push your own boundaries, she tells us. But right now, I was just a 17-year-old from the coast with a handful of change from pulling pints in the pub in the evenings. Told by the careers officer that the life she yearns for is impossible, she leaves school at 18 and takes a job on a boat providing wildlife tours of the local islands. But the work environment is toxic. When a doctor diagnoses a kidney infection, the result of dehydration brought on by 70-hour work weeks in the hot sun with few breaks, she's told to show up or be fired. Eventually, Stowe finds her way onto a sailing ship with researchers studying bottlenose whales off Newfoundland. One still night of freezing fog and nauseous exhaustion, she has a surprise meeting. It was her turn at watch to remain awake, monitoring the radar for looming icebergs. Sensing a deep marine presence in the night, she sees a dark shape rising from the sea. Something lumpy, a soft glisten of water on an almost gelatinous form. Almost as if it took offense at my curiosity, the animal sent a wet cloud of breath spraying into my face. Laughing into the black night at her first sperm whale, she hardly needs to tell us that this is why she is here, freezing and nauseous, rather than snuggled under her duvet at home 1,000 miles away. I had found my north, the area of life into which I wanted to pour my passion. Throughout Move Like Water, we are treated to little lectures about marine creatures and seabirds, but Stowe's book is at its best when recounting her travails and triumphs in the first person. She writes about a dip in the ocean while recovering from a spinal injury. I felt alive again, momentarily cleansed, my body burning from the cold salt water rather than from my damaged nerves. I felt like me, like the sea. My aim with this book was to give you an ocean to hold in your hands, she says. I am holding it. This review was written by Carl Safina, whose newest book is Alfie and Me, What Owls Know, What Humans Believe. How to Build a Boat by Elaine Feeney. This tender novel, which was long listed for the Booker Prize, follows a boy as he works to build a perpetual motion machine, which to him is not just an engineering project, but a way to get closer to the mother he never knew. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.